Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We also call this Rethink the Week, and we tape it on Friday morning, which means we're taping it right after the State of the Union that took place on Thursday night. I always begin with some sort of an opening salvo, and our good friend Skip Tenzer, who writes political limericks, sent me something the other night after he was listening to Mitch McConnell, and he said, I'm not sure that you can read this on the air. And I read it, and I went, I can read it on the air, trust me, and I'm gonna. Here we go. McConnell is retiring from the Capitol halls. He's endorsing the Donald and building his walls. Caring little for the nation, Mitch opts for castration as Trump's Senate lackey, a man with no balls. It's fine with me. Love it. Incredibly accurate. All right. Now joining us for our Rethink the Week is our fabulous group of panelists. Laura Jadid is a freelance journalist who primarily focuses on the American conservative movement. Her bylines include the New Republic, Rolling Stone, and New York Magazine. Welcome back, Laura.
Always great to be here, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. Stephen Pimpare is a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. He is the author of four books. His most recent book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change, received the 2023 Best Book Award from the Society for Social Work and Research. Welcome back, Mr. Pimpare.
Thank you, Arnie. Happy to be here.
A pleasure. And finalmente, Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of eight books. He's appeared on CNN, Reuters, and New York Times. I can go on about where his writings, but if you want to actually follow him, you can go to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Mitchell.
Always a pleasure to be here, Arnie.
I'm sure it is.
It's 7 o'clock in the morning in San Francisco.
Are you in San Francisco?
Yeah, I'm in Mark. Yes.
Oh, well, it's early, early, early. Thank you so much for doing this. As I was thinking about all the conversations we're going to be having today about the State of the Union, again, everybody was terrified. You know that, and I know that. I think Joe Biden did remarkably well. And given the fact that he is old and stutters, he did an amazing job at age 81. I've been thinking a lot about what he was talking about. And one of the things that I thought about was that my biggest concern was, would people get the sense that he saw them? And I think he did. I think he really emphasized the different sort of segments of the population saying, I see you, I believe in you, and I'm going to make it better for you. Because again, all the Bidenomics is about how good it is, but not necessarily good for the vast majority of Americans who've seen their food bill go up by over 20%, who've seen their gas bill go up by over 30% since he became president. Yes, some of those things have lowered in an inflation way, but when you actually are looking at your out-of-pocket expenses, that's not the case. We're looking at the cost of housing going through the roof. I mean, it's all these things. And for most Americans, that's everything that they earn a living for, is to pay for those. So that means they're getting less for more money. Before I begin by talking to you, I thought I would grab what Bill Curry's reaction was. Bill Curry joins us normally every week, and he lost his partner last week, so he is going to be out of pocket for a while. But he had to weigh in about the speech, and he's a little bit of a curmudgeon and does not want Joe Biden to run again. In fact, he wants something to happen at the convention, which I think we're all on the same page will probably not happen. But here's what he wrote. I thought the Republicans were especially well cast. It sure helps us that they can't help themselves. Biden still isn't all the way to the analysis of the problem vision of the future thing, but we may exaggerate the need for one. Obama, W, and especially Clinton all got reelected without one. In 96, Clinton vowed to build a bridge to the future, which being entirely metaphorical had the advantage of costing a lot less than the real infrastructure program he forgot he ran on in 1992. Biden's performance last night reminded me of the era the Carter folks made with Reagan in 80. Painting him all year as such a doddering, sensitive old fool that when he showed up for the debate with a pulse, their entire case crumbled. I'm not as pumped as some of my friends this morning, but it sure feels good to wake up without quite so dire a sense of foreboding. Onward and forward. So, Laura Jadid, you cover the conservative movement, and I do have to say that at one point, my friend Robert Hockett thought that the Speaker of the House did a fine job sitting behind Joe Biden, and I'm going, were you looking at the same speaker I was looking at? But I do think that the gift from God was the response from the senator from Alabama. And one of the reasons why I thought she was a gift from God, it was like, it's almost like she was like the Betty Crocker candidate for the GOP. I mean, she's sitting in her kitchen. She's from Alabama. She's wearing her cross prominently, you know, displayed in her sort of plunging neckline shirt. She's talking about IVF for the state that basically has done almost everything to make it very difficult for people to access IVF. And of course, she wails about the bill. She wails about the border and goes on and on in incredibly graphic ways about the border. But you know what she forgot to tell people? Here's what she forgot to tell people. And I'm really grateful every once in a while that I am watching MSNBC, because this is what Rachel Maddow said last night. Wow, Senator Britt was one of the senators who is involved in the negotiations to create a border bill. She helped create the bill and then voted against it when Trump called on Republicans to pull the plug on the bill that they themselves negotiated. Oh, Laura, I mean, if I could have had a ticker underneath Senator Britt, I would have been saying, liar, liar, pants on fire. But anyway, your reaction to last night, your reaction to what Bill said, and just your thoughts as we now realize we're in full campaign mode.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Bill Curry nailed it. And he mentioned something that I had not thought of, which I think is absolutely in play, which is, yeah, one of the hazards of portraying Biden as a doddering old fool is that when he shows up and does the bare minimum, it looks great. And he did. He did the bare, you know what? He even did a little bit more than the bare minimum. I'm very pleased with his performance. I did not come in optimistic. I was absolutely prepared to pan it. He did good. He did all right. Even when he went off script with Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, I wish he hadn't used the word illegal, but considering that was off the cuff, I have no issue with it. I think it was also kind of a show of strength. Oh, you can go off script. That's good. The senator from Alabama, that was I found that very amusing. I don't know who that was for. I'll be honest. Every time a woman opens by being like, you know, well, I'm a senator, but really what matters to me is being a mother. Then why aren't you home with your kids? Like, what the heck?
Well, she is. You didn't see them behind the kitchen table.
Oh, yeah, that's true. She was in the kitchen. You're right. She was in the kitchen where women belong.
Yes, talking just exactly.
Horrifically graphic descriptions of rape, another thing I think the Republicans are giving us is, I don't think because they live in these worlds where they like just dwell in these paranoid universes where all they do is think about graphic rape and genital mutilation, I don't think they realize how weird that is to normal Americans. I feel like they chose her because they felt like she would be relatable. She's, you know, she's young, she's pretty, she's smiling, a little too much, honestly. This was very much a look at me. I'm a normal human being, just like you. I don't think she pulled it off. I could be wrong, but I don't think she seemed very normal. I think she seemed like a caricature. I think she felt very theatrical to me. I don't know who that was for. And I think she did a terrible job and I couldn't be more pleased.
She and Marjorie Taylor Greene wearing her hat, her MAGA hat. I mean, the two of them together were like the best split screen on the planet. So Stephen Pimper, I was also thinking about Senator Britt. She's running for VP. So we know that she's on the short list for VP. And I think, again, that was the performance mode for Donald Trump and for Donald Trump alone. That was the only reason she was doing it, going, just think about this. You know, even if you die in office, I'll carry on your message. And I'm a really great communicator, because actually that's her background. She was the communications director for one of the senators down south. Maybe I can't even remember, probably from Alabama. But you know what's interesting to me? As I'm looking at her and I'm seeing her in the kitchen and I'm looking at all the war on women and the war on abortion and the war on delivery, and then now we're going to be a forced incubator, then they're going to tell us we can't have babies. I'm like, out of my mind. There was an interesting Gallup poll, and since you're kind of the sociologist in the crowd, Mr. Pimper, I'm trying to figure this out. So the headline was, new Gallup poll findings show that 57% of Americans believe the country would be better run if more women held political office. And then, of course, they did a little bit of a deep dive. Gallup began tracking Americans' attitudes about women in politics in 1999, when the percentage of Americans thought the country would be better off with more women in office was also 57%. Whoopee, this is like kind of interesting. But this is the part that I'm sort of curious about. The percentage of Americans who think the country would be worse off with more women in political office has risen from 8 points since 1999, from 14% to 22%. And I suspect that the woman in the kitchen last night, that's where the percentage is from. I think because you heard Joe Biden, Stephen Pimper, talking to the Supreme Court about the women are going to send you a message. Well, now you understand why they don't think women would be good in political office, because the GOP is now terrified of what? Of women with breasts. You know, they're afraid that if you have a vagina and a breast, you are terrifying to a Republican, because they've done everything to invite them into the voting booth because they put the target on their back. And I thought that it was just so interesting to look at this Gallup poll, to then see Britt and to hear Joe Biden last night specifically speaking to women, specifically speaking to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm wondering if that's going to create the kind of cocktail we need in order to win in November. I think, you know, Joe Biden didn't stumble last night, but I think there's going to be a lot of cleanup that we have to do. And I suspect, once again, it's going to be the women that are going to be asked to do the cleanup.
I would also want to see the partisan breakdown on that yep. poll. And I suspect that most of that increase is among Republicans, because yes. if you build a party identity around misogyny and xenophobia and racism, right, those are going to become part of the partisan identity. I want to violate the primary rule of punditocracy and talk a little bit about substance rather than the theatrics. And of course, these are theatrical events. They're
exactly.
in an election year. They are a kickoff to the campaign. We all recognize that. But they are also agenda setting events in a normal administration. And this is going on behind the scenes in ways that people tend not to be aware of. But this is often part of the budget building process as well. And each of the agencies goes to the White House and says, here are our priorities. Here are the programs that we would like to see created or built upon. And here are the ones that we want you to mention in the State of the Union, because if the president makes a commitment out loud in front of a very large national audience, it increases the chances that there will be efforts down the road made to actually get those policies enacted into law. And if we take a look at that policy agenda that he articulated, it is, from what we know of other public opinion polling, wildly popular.
Yes. Right?
Setting aside the question of what part is the composition of Congress looks like and whether any of this is actually doable, right? Nationwide protections for in vitro fertilization, codifying in one way or another Roe or abortion protections into law, reinstantiation of the expanded child tax credit, a new homeowner's tax credit of $400 a month for people buying a new house, a commitment to universal free pre-K, expanded access to community college, renewed commitment to American-made products, buying American with American workers, lots of attention to unions and to wages and to job security. I could go on, right? Now, again, how much of that will wind up being made into law? But that is an enormously positive agenda. And the last thing I'll say, if we think about the large structure of the speech, was the framing of it, right? It was the future versus the past. It was hope versus fear. It was democracy versus authoritarianism. It was fighting for the middle class rather than fighting for the rich. It was honesty and decency versus lies and hate. That's not a particularly radical way of framing a political campaign, right? That's Obama, right? But if you are then backing it up with policies that we know large numbers of people support, and you can let them know that,
right,
I think that can have meaningful impact on the campaign.
I agree with you. And Lincoln, one of the things I thought was so interesting is that not only did he said, look, the rich can be rich, but they just have to pay their fair share of taxes. You know, and he gave the numbers. He didn't just say that, no, you can be as rich as you want, but when you only pay on average 8.5% in taxes and the plumber pays 21% or whatever, I'm just saying, do what they do. So he attacked the rich, but he protected the rich at the same time. He just kind of said, just cut a bigger check. Okay, that's all he said. And then I thought what was so interesting is he didn't talk about the poor, but he did. And how he talked about the poor was by talking about the middle class, because it was the middle class, he said, which was the pathway for the poor. The rich are not the pathway for the poor. It is a vibrant middle class that provides an opportunity for the poor to be able to ultimately lift themselves into a position where they can be middle class. So his connection to his support for the middle class was not about forgetting about the poor, but reminding them that it's this vibrant middle class that is the pathway for the poor. It is not about protecting and putting a moat around the rich. And I thought that that was an interesting way of not mentioning the poor, but mentioning the poor. And that was the first time I've actually heard him use the word. And everyone, he even said the minimum wage. He has not used the term, Lincoln, minimum wage, an increase in the minimum wage, in years. But last night we heard the minimum wage. So yeah, there was a lot of things you could work with. And then the question is, he says, can I deliver? Only if you not only reelect me, but you bring me people that will work with me. Lincoln.
That framing you described, I think would be very helpful during the 1980s and 1990s. The problem now is that there is no middle class.
Yeah.
And we've talked about on this show over and over and over again. And yes, I thought it was a good speech. To be completely frank, I didn't watch it, but I kind of read about it a little bit, watched some clips. I thought it was a good speech. But there is no middle class. The biggest change between my generation or Joe Biden's generation, who's frankly my parents' generation, and my children's generation, is that Joe Biden and I, about 30 years apart in age, grew up in middle class, in a middle class country. My children did not.
Yes.
So you have to talk about the poor, because the problem in America is poverty. And the way we're going, not the problem, the problem we're talking about here is poverty. And I don't know that we really address that problem by continuing this American myth that A, this is a middle class country, and B, everyone is in the middle class. In the industrialized world, if you are 30 years old and work 50 to 70 hours a week and think you have a realistic chance of paying off your loans to get an education before your first grandchild is born, and don't think you'll ever own your own home and are worried that what is functionally your pension, your Social Security, will not allow you to live out your old age in any kind of economic security and dignity, you are not middle class. And to keep pretending we are, because that's what America is, right? Biden loves this phrase, America is this, America is not. He'll say things that are un-American. Stopping people from voting because of the color of their skin is un-American. There's nothing more American than that. And we have to begin to recognize who this country is and who we are and what the reality on the ground is. I don't expect that of Joe Biden. What I expect of Joe Biden is not Donald Trump. And he will deliver on that. And that's why we have to vote for him.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about the middle class. But look at all the programs he talked about. Those are poor people programs. He couldn't call them that. He couldn't tell them that. But if you're giving everyone $400 a month for a credit to buy a house, that's not about a middle class person being able to afford a house. That's about basically a welfare check of $400. That's the Section 8 of housing.
And it's not going to get you to a down payment on a house because you're poor.
Right. But I'm not going to do it.
I'm not saying it's bad policies, but I'm saying if we really want, I mean, we have talked so much on this show as recently as last week about the gravity of the economic problems. And while this is a Congress that for a whole lot of reasons isn't going to go for the kind of things we'd all like. These are all steps in the right direction. I agree with that, but I just wanted to make that point because I want to be consistent with what we've said in the past on this very show. The other point I would make is that Biden spoke about democracy a bit last night. And that is the major issue. And none of these other issues can be addressed if this fascist movement succeeds. And I'm glad that he spoke about it. I wish that he would speak about it more and more consistently, because to build a consensus that we don't want to be part of this multinational rising fascist movement and we're going to oppose that is essential. And that has to start with Biden. And I think he did a bit of that last night. And I think he kind of has to stay on that during the campaign, because that's where the majority is going to come from.
I disagree a little bit with Lincoln about this idea of democracy, because democracy has been such a disappointment. And when you are disappointed and disappointed and disappointed, it's even disappointing when you take democracy into your own hands. Let me introduce you to Florida, okay? Where Florida passed the bill about, changing the Constitution about ex-felons being given the right to vote. And 61 or 65% of Floridians did it. And then that was democracy in action, they thought. And then they had a governor and they had a legislature that basically made it impossible to get to goal. When you keep hearing about democracy and then recognizing that the Affordable Care Act gave up the public option, and then when you hear about democracy, even with Joe Biden talking last night about insulin costing $35 a month, but you have to be 65 or older to get that. What if you've got a kid with that? So, again, I think part of the problem is we want to talk about democracy and the threat of democracy, but democracy for so many people has been such a disappointment that we have to somehow convince them that not only do we want them to vote for democracy, but we're talking about a democracy that is more vibrant, that is more responsive, that isn't gerrymandered to death, that doesn't make it impossible for them to exercise the franchise, that actually delivers on the policies they care about. And I think that's part of the problem is democracy doesn't have the same resonance because people are so disappointed in what they see as not being produced vis-a-vis democracy.
Oh. I do definitely think that this is a, I mean, I think one of the reasons that the Republicans have been so successful is that there's a feeling that something's got to give and something's got to change. And say what you want about the Republican Party and their absolutely terrifying agenda, but they are promising a change. I don't like the change, but they are promising it. And Biden and the Democrats are the party of the status quo at this point. That being said, I do think that focusing on policy, even if policy, I think I agree that, you know, this policy will help poor people. I don't personally expect to ever have a mortgage. I wasn't particularly moved by that promise. You know, the thing is, people don't like to be called poor. Biden's job last night wasn't to tell us the truth. Biden's job was to present a picture that is compelling to the American people. I don't love that perspective. I think that offline, like not on the State of the Union, we need to be working on things like policy. I think the policies that he mentioned were good, and I'm glad that he called them middle class policies, because poor people don't want to be told they're poor for the most part. People, the myth of the middle class is very much alive and well, and a president that dispels that myth is correct, and it's something that needs to happen. I just don't think State of the Union is the place to do it necessarily. I also think anybody that people are either convinced there's a threat to democracy or they aren't. I think at this stage, people are pretty much decided on that. I think Biden needs to continue to remind people, definitely. But the problem is, it's just not that shocking anymore. It was shocking in 2016. It was certainly shocking in 2020. You know, last week, Trump claimed that Mexico is sending Hannibal Lecter into the country. He said that. Those are the words that he said. Who cares? We expect it. This is what he is. This is the eighth, ninth year that he's been on the public stage. We know what he is. It's not shocking anymore. People are like, why isn't the media covering this? Because it's not news. That's why. So I do think that he should continue to hammer democracy, but I also think he should do exactly what he did last night, which is propose real policy positions that do help people and do it in an upbeat tone. I mean, again, there's other places where we should address the actual fact that we don't have a middle class, but last night wasn't the place, and I think he did great.
I'm going to toss to you, Mr. Pimpare, but then we only have a few minutes left and I'll come back to you right after the break. You've heard me say this a million times, Stephen, and I'm going to say it again. And to a large extent, maybe it mirrors what Laura just said. And that is, Americans are philosophically conservative, but operationally liberal. Let me repeat that. Philosophically conservative, but operationally liberal. They don't want to hear that they're poor. They don't want to hear about taxes. They don't want to hear about regulations. They don't want to hear that the, you know, the government is here to help, because Ronald Reagan said that's the worst words ever. But in the end, they want all those things. They want to know about taxes because they want to know that the rich are paying something. They do want to have regulation because they want to make sure that the water they drink is safe, that the air they breathe is safe, that someone is actually watching out for them, because corporations don't care about their safety. They care about their profits. They don't, I mean, what is so frightening is that we have this conservative headset that isn't even sure that they care about democracy. But then when they don't get what they want, they're furious. How do we connect the idea that a democracy that is truly democratic, that is really inclusive, that is more fair, that recognizes their right to the power that they are given with the franchise, that connects to outcomes? And I guess maybe in a large extent, maybe the abortion issue and the IVF issue may be the best way to connect the dots, because he even said it last night to the Supreme Court. Watch the power of women, both politically as well as engaging when it comes to this election. And that was about democracy and power. And I think in a funny way, abortion may be the best way for us to teach that lesson.
The overwhelming majority of Americans are not ideologues. And by that, I mean that they do not have a coherent set of policy preferences. They don't think about these things in the way that we do, right? They don't make the connections. I don't think ultimately the way that we re-engage people in democratic practice is a rhetorical task. It is a task of local, on-the-ground organizing and building power from the ground up. And that is difficult and exhausting and slow and frustrating and unappealing to lots of people. But my read of our history is that if we are in need of fundamental structural reform, it comes from capacity building over long periods of time that prepares itself for a crisis large enough that it is able to insert itself and disrupt the system. These are not easy things to do in a speech.
And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has done everything in reverse. Yes, really quickly, Lincoln.
If these policies were going to help Biden, they would have already. We're sitting here saying he's got this idea, this idea, this idea. He has done more in his first term than any Democratic president since Lyndon Johnson, and he's still struggling in the polls. To think that a few more policies, a few more nudges in one speech is going to make a difference is why.
We got to go to break, and I'm going to challenge you on that one, Lincoln. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week. We're taping on Friday morning. We're going to be rejoined by Laura Jadid, Stephen Pimper, and Lincoln Mitchell. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. The organization No Labels has decided they are definitely running a presidential ticket this year. They haven't said who's on that ticket. We don't know who will be on that ticket yet. We do know a couple things. They have no chance of winning. They almost certainly won't even be close in any particular state. And No Labels may, in fact, help send Donald Trump back to the White House. That seems to be what their agenda is at the end of the day. There's something else here that's really troubling. No Labels presents itself in some sanctimonious position saying we're going to get past the polarization in America. We need to come together. No labels, no red, no blue, no Democrat, no Republican. The problem with that is it's a false equivalency. The major problem facing the United States isn't polarization. The major threat isn't polarization. It's fascism. The major problem is the Republican Party has been taken over by this populist MAGA fascist movement and suggesting that the real problem is that, you know, Democrats are too far left and Republicans are too far right simply isn't true. And it doesn't hold the GOP accountable. And No Labels is exacerbating that false equivalency and that problem.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call it Rethink the Week. We tape it on Friday mornings. We're rejoined by Laura Jadid, a freelance journalist, Stephen Pimper, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy, and Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. Now, Lincoln, you butted into Stephen Pimper's time, so I want to just clarify something. And Stephen, when I was mentioning that Americans are philosophically conservative, but operationally liberal, and you heard Lincoln just at the end of the last half hour, basically say that, you know, if policy would be helpful to Joe Biden, then he would be wildly successful, because look at the incredible policies that he was able to successfully get through Congress. So Stephen, let me just say something. That is, I said at the very beginning, you know, I was talking about the cost of food and the cost of gasoline and the cost. So all the policies that he was wildly successful at getting through, who did it help? Well, it's about infrastructure that isn't finished yet. It's about Wall Street that most of us aren't invested in. It's about, you know, bringing down the price of drugs for people over the age of 65. And then the rest of the drugs will go into effect for 2025. And then what did people lose? They lost their earned income tax credit. What did families lose? They lost their free lunch. What did family lose? They lost their ability to sort of stay in their apartment, but before they were basically being evicted. So when you look at what real people, not Wall Street, not infrastructure, not all that stuff, those are big policies. But the things that touched people's lives, Stephen, it didn't get better. And everything that Joe Biden talked about last night was much more on the micro scale, more specific to people that would have an immediate response and an immediate need than what was successful for him in the first two or three years. And I think we have to distinguish between that big policy and how people live their lives. Mr. Pimpare, you're the sociologist in the family. I don't know about policy. I know I have less money in my bank and I can't pay for the same amount of food. That's what I know. And telling me about an infrastructure bill isn't going to be persuasive.
So just to be, I don't want to be guilty of misrepresenting myself. I'm actually a political scientist, okay. not a sociologist, to all my sociologist friends.
Okay. I apologize.
Apologize to them. So I said this last week, I believe, but I'm going to say it again. We've got research from behavioral economics that tells us that people feel a loss more profoundly than they feel an equivalent gain. During the last chunk of 2020 on into 2021, right, we had a spate of legislation that cut poverty in half, that sent people checks periodically for no particular reason, right, that imposed an eviction moratorium, that suspended repayment of student loans, on and on and on and on and on, right? And in an act of what I continue to argue was political malpractice, those policies were structured so that they would expire in the mistaken belief that they would become so popular that there would be a groundswell of support in order to stop Congress from letting them expire, right? That is politically naive at best. So those programs have now all been rolled back, right? So we cut poverty in half, we cut child poverty in half, and then we doubled poverty, and then we doubled child poverty, right? So, you know, I can tell you that as of this morning, we got new employment data that tells us that we have had the longest streak of unemployment rate below 4% since 1969. Mm-hmm. That is a meaningful bit of data if, as Laura referred to, right? You don't think you're ever going to be able to buy a home. You figure you're going to be paying off student loans until you're dead. You're struggling to figure out how to provide childcare for your kids, on and on and on, right? The material impact of that is much more important than any of the larger things. The last thing that I will say is, if we are going to place faith in rhetorical statements in order to alter politics, to agree with what I think a lot of us are saying, we need to not be doing what Biden did last night, which is this small bore, largely around the margin stuff, but start a conversation about fundamental structural reform, about the undemocratic systems that govern and misgovern us and make it exceedingly difficult for us to recognize policies that benefit us, our family, and our communities.
Where do you teach that? How do you educate that? I mean, again, I'm going to go back to what I think the Republicans have been so effective at doing compared to the Democrats. The Democrats did everything from top down. The Republicans didn't. They worked the bottom up. They eroded the base. They massaged the base. They misled the base. And they did it not just through politics. They used faith, because you go into the Midwest and every single radio station is a Christian station. But when you listen to those Christian stations, they sound more like a GOP station than a Christian station, but they're everywhere. They're pervasive. And then they have their own little news outlet called Fox. And then they have everything else. But they have always massaged the base. And I've told this story before. Ralph Reed, thank you. Yeah, short little guy. I can describe him. I just can't remember his name. It's Ralph Reed. But what Ralph Reed said, now listen to what he said. Ralph Reed said to me in 1990 that by the end of the 90s, they would control the fundamentalist evangelical Christian base would be controlling 2/3 of the Republican Party. They would control it by the end of the 1990s. They were successful by 1997. They were ahead of themselves by 3 years. And then you look at what's going on right now with the MAGA crowd, and you look at the white evangelical Christian base, and you look at Speaker Johnson, for example, and you think, oh my God, how wildly successful they were. But they knew where to focus, and they didn't focus on the top of the ticket. They focused on taking over the framework of the bottom and to make sure that the bottom was secure for them. And that's something that Democrats put all their faith in, who's ever sitting in the White House. And you can't do that anymore, especially when you see the damage happening in governors' states all over the country. The damage is unbelievable. And it doesn't just stay in Louisiana or Texas or Iowa or Florida. It is now flipping over and oozing into the blue states. So we're now all vulnerable, Lincoln. So
there's a lot of questions there. I'm going to try with mixed success to unpack this. First, I don't think it's entirely accurate to say that Democrats put all their faith in the person in the White House. The Republican Party is a cult. That is dramatically different. There's a couple of points here I would try to answer kind of from two different directions. One is that what happened in the Republican Party, and I would say beginning with the frustration, and I know I'm a political scientist, not a historian, but indulge me for a second, that many on the far right felt when Eisenhower beat out Taft for the nomination in 1952. And there was a newspaper story at that time of a Taft delegate walking out, turning to his friend, you know, and saying, oh, I guess the country's going to go communist for another 8 years now. Then we get to Goldwater in 64, Reagan, et cetera. What happened in the Republican Party was an effort by what was once a tiny faction, and is now, as you point out, basically the whole party, to take over the party from the far right. And you can track this from Goldwater, the John Birch Society. As late as 76, Reagan was considered essentially a right-wing fringe character on national politics, all the way to Mike Johnson, the kind of porn-obsessed, puritanical, very strange Speaker of the House we have now, and everyone in between. The Democratic Party, upon seeing this, and they did it through creating alternate institutions, from the John Birch Society to talk radio, to ultimately to Fox, right, to... I can't think of the name of it, but the organization that controls all the Supreme Court justices.
Federalist Society.
Heritage Foundation.
Called the Feudalist Society, which would have been better.
Feudalist.
All of these organizations. What the Democratic Party did was they created structures to counter those, but those were structures led from the center of the Democratic Party. Air America is not some left-wing thing. It's a mainstream Democratic thing. The New York Times, right? NPR, all of these, MSNBC. People call MSNBC, on the right, they refer to it kind of, to be clever, as MSDNC. But the point is, it reflects the views of the mains. There's never been an effort, a concerted effort by the left to do that. And I want to go back to one other reason for this. And again, I'm sorry for sounding like an academic here, but there are many major differences between our two political parties. One of them is the following. The Democratic Party is a much broader coalition. So you speak right now, at this moment, about the Republican Party's, you know, it's a right-wing, overwhelmingly white Christian nationalist base that probably represents 20 to 30% of the American people. Now, there's two issues here. One, the left wing of the Democratic Party, and I say this who's identified myself politically there since before I was old enough to vote, we're not that big. We have to recognize that. We keep losing elections within the party. We're not that big. Secondly, we have a range of issues which that to some people, the left wing right now means, you know, economic justice. To others, it has to do with race and policing. To others, it has to do with supporting Ukraine. To others, it has to do with not supporting Ukraine. And let's not even get started on Gaza.
Yeah.
When you ask why this happens, the answer is the nature of the coalitions are very, very different.
So, Laura, I'm doing a lot now about public education and the war on public education, whether it's from Hillsdale or Betsy DeVos, or whether you're seeing it happening with vouchers in Texas, whether you're seeing it. So and you know, when you find out that the earliest supporters of vouchers, of charters, of all those things to undermine public education were Democrats. Not Republicans, it was Democrats. Democrats waved the white flag and said, we're not going to improve public education. We're going to give a way out of dealing with that issue. And that's exactly what a charter is. It's not saying we need to fix public education. It's, oh, you can leave. What is a voucher? We're not going to fix public education. Oh, you can leave. All right. And that's exactly what the Republicans wanted. Only we carried their water. And when you look at some of the people that were the commissioners of education all over the country, a lot of them are Democrats that were supporting it. So what did we do? We did not make a commitment to public education. We actually were jealous of Republicans. And we thought, okay, this is our way of dealing with public education. We'll give you a ticket out. And it was Democrats that did it, not Republicans. Look at Clinton in the 1990s. It was Clinton that got basically all those things that were a wet dream for Newt Gingrich about what happened to the financial markets. We're the ones that delivered it. So as much as we're angry at Republicans, look what the Democrats did. They wanted to be liked. They wanted to attract billionaire money. They didn't want to rock the boat. And everything they rocked in the direction of Republicans. And ultimately, now the Republicans are wildly successful. But who they have to thank is not the Christian base. They have to thank the Democratic Party, because we're the ones that sold ourselves out, Laura.
Oh, look, yeah, no, the Democrats, I like to fantasize that someday before I die, the Democrats will realize that they'll only ever be the second best Republicans. Like they continue to, since the 90s, since Clinton, I absolutely agree. And worse, we've ceded the Republican framing of issues. This is what makes me so angry about the immigration thing that we're doing right now, is that rather than being like, no, it's actually great that we have immigrants. We've always been a nation of immigrants. We need to loosen legal immigration and then expand our ability to screen people so that we can get people to come in, the lifeblood of this country. That could have been how we did it. And instead, we've got Biden giving what I will agree is a rhetorically decent tactic of being like, I wanted to fix the immigrant policy and I wanted to stop all the fentanyl from killing your babies, but I couldn't because the mean Republicans wouldn't let me. Okay, I've heard worse strategies rhetorically, but we have still ceded ground to the Republicans, as you point out, we have for decades. And this is where I think some of the frustration with the State of the Union is that's decades of ceding ground. The battle lines are drawn. Everyone knows what this election is about. We've known for months. It's exhausting. It's March. We have so many more months of this. And yet we know what this is. We know what the policy issues are. So it feels very stupid to talk about them. After all, as Lincoln points out, as you point out, it would have worked already, right? But also, if worry about democracy was really a big thing, that would have worked already. It's just everything feels very static and frozen, and it's really hard to see how Biden can break out of that specifically and how the State of the Union specifically could have done it.
So, Stephen, I've given a lot of leadership talks and they brought me in. You know, I'm like the poster child for women in politics because I was like the first girl. And one of the things I remember speaking to a group of women once was that I'm going to invite you into the political process, but I'm going to remind you of something. Most of you will lose. Not win. You will lose. Now, if you understand that, then you understand why you have to run. You know, and I'm going to go back to my great Bella Abzug's quote. You have to lose, lose, lose to win. The difference between Republicans and Democrats is that Democrats lose and run away. They give up. They don't say, well, why did we lose? How do we massage this? How do we build on this? How do we come back again? How do we come back again? So they never build on any foundation that they attempt to create through policy, through education, through a knowledge of the democracy, of their support for public education. They don't win and they go, all right, well, let's do a charter. They don't win by supporting public education, or let's do a voucher. I mean, and then the Republicans take those little kernels of change and then they totally destroy public education because they expand on it. And I guess part of the problem is that we haven't even taught people about what democracy is. And you heard it last night from Joe Biden, that you still love your country even when you lose. That was a really powerful statement, Stephen. And that's really been why I've been doing this for decades. Is that I understand about losing. Because ultimately, if I lose enough and I educate enough and I build enough, you have a potential to win. But if you lose and run away, and you lose your trash, your party, your trash, your country, you've lost everything, Stephen Pimpare.
So the fact that you often will need to lose, lose, lose before you can win is not only true in electoral politics, it is true in policy advocacy as well. It is true at all kinds of change that you want to make along all levels of the political system, for some of the reasons that Lincoln and Lohr were both articulating is that you know, those of us who would like to see much more inclusive, expansive, equality-producing policies are not necessarily even a large majority of the Democratic Party. And when you look at that coalition and its supporters, while depending on the election, you will see relatively equal amounts of money going to the Democratic and Republican parties. As Lincoln was articulating, the Republican Party has a secondary set of institutions to supplement that that have been built since the 1970s, explicitly designed to create disproportionate influence for wealthy individuals and corporate actors. And the problem is that while, as I said earlier, right, the policies that Biden articulated, pick any poll, they're going to be wildly popular, right? We may have numbers, they've got money and institutions of power. And that's a really hard thing to beat. It's beatable. But it takes time. It's what Max Weber called it, the long and slow boring of hard boards, right? Yes. Consistent pressure applied over long periods of time. And that's a really hard sell for a lot of people in a moment when it is perfectly rational to want to disengage from politics. It's tough. It's a really tough problem.
So Lincoln, I was talking to some people about the economy and how they felt that they had been abandoned and it wasn't helpful to them. And they were talking about the cost of eggs being $2.99 and they were talking about the cost of gas being, you know, $3.50 or whatever. And so, and they said it was better during the pandemic. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, not only did we get that extra money, okay, that came in from the government, but you know what they said to me? And I think we need to remember this. They didn't go in their cars, so they didn't have to spend money on gas. They didn't go out to eat because they had to eat at home. They didn't have to buy wardrobes because they weren't leaving their house. They didn't have to think of all the cost of just working. In order to work, you have to spend money to work. Okay. And I don't think we quite understand that. So here is the government hysterical about the pandemic, trying to keep people in a place where they can be safe so we don't spread it. We already know about the million that are dead. And yet what we did was we gave them all these supports so that while they were staying at home, they were not only surviving, they were kind of thriving. They were thriving. And then they were sent back to work and then we pulled everything away. And so I think when we try to understand how devastating that is, I don't think we've actually done the math that most families are living. And when you actually do the math, you suddenly realize all those safety net services didn't just belong during a pandemic. They belong. They belong. You look at the free lunch program right now in Massachusetts, in Vermont, in Maine, every child gets a free lunch. Every child, if they want it, they get it. My state of New Hampshire, you have to be at 135% of poverty in order to get a free lunch. And the cost of even figuring out whether you qualify is costing us more than if we gave them the damn free lunch. So I think we don't actually understand how people are really feeling because it is so different, Lincoln, so, so different and so much more vulnerable.
You know, you spoke about the free lunches in some of these states, and I'm reminded of Mitt Romney, who is now viewed as some kind of, you know, resistance hero and man of great integrity and all this, who suggested that people believe they are entitled to food. Well, you know what? People are entitled to food. I mean, and but what really strikes me, and I think I'm going to go in a totally different direction here than what you asked, perfectly, but I'm going to respond. But I'm going to respond to your question. First, I would make a caveat. All of those things were true, except for the people who had to work, who died in higher numbers. I know you understand that. Right. Now I'm going to make a very strange metaphor. In the Gulag Archipelago, which if you have about 60 hours and want to get really, really depressed, I recommend you read with a light soupçon of anti-Semitism, which is appropriate for the era, for the moment we are living in now. They talk about how in the Gulag, the smart prisoners, known as Zeks in Z-H-E-K-S in Russian, the smart prisoners realized that if they worked, they got lower rations. But if they didn't work, they got their food ration cut. Right. But if they worked, they fell behind faster and died faster. And that is a in the middle of a nasty, you know, allegedly a communist system. That is a metaphor for capitalism at its ugliest.
Yes.
And what strikes me, I'm not comparing the plight of a working American to a prisoner in Stalin's gulag. I am making a mathematical metaphor.
Right.
But what you are talking about is very real. If you get hired for that good job, you have a college degree, you have a little debt, but you have a college degree, and you're not working, you know, in finance or law, and you're making, because I know people fresh out of college working in things they want to work in, you're making $45,000 a year. Now, if you don't have wheels, you got to think about buying a car. You know, if you have a car, you got to think about spending 2 hours on public transportation, which isn't all that cheap. You can't afford to live the city I'm living in now, what I'm staying in now, because my mother has been living here since 1971 and I'm staying at her place. So you live in El Cerrito, and now it's $20-25 a day on BART.
Yeah.
Then I can't wear my beat up. I can't wear this shirt, which is a hand-me-down. So you just get deeper and deeper into the hole. And the fundamental problem is that over the last 200 years, we have had a shift in how we understand what human beings are supposed to do.
Right.
And I mean, at a very primal level. Most people now understand and believe that what human beings are meant to do, that we've evolved to do, is to work. And as long as we believe that you do not deserve shelter, you are not entitled to anything other than the streets and a handout, unless you work 50 hours a week. And that is America today. That is the social contract. And that social contract is absolutely devastating in so many ways, not least of which it accelerates the destruction of the climate, which will make this planet unlivable. Because what we do is we worship at this altar of work, 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 buy things, no, but make things people don't need, make people buy more things, and cause more damage. So I know you bring me on my show for the show for the optimism. That's the best I can do.
So Laura, but it's so amazing because I've heard it from Stephen Pimper, the idea of the virtue of work. And what we are now talking about is it ain't so virtuous. We're now talking about the cost of work. We're now talking about the healthcare complications from work. All the things that now this virtue of work is now undermining. You know, and I go back to Governor Reynolds of Iowa. So there's this free lunch program that has been offered to all the states for the summer because kids are not in school to get their free lunches. So what does Governor Reynolds say? We're not going to accept all these millions and millions of dollars that will go on an EBT card that will replace the school lunches. Why? Because there's a problem with obesity in Iowa. Listen to that answer. Listen to that answer. You can become apoplectic, but not only do we not think that there is a need for people to have access to food, but then we now then say, but they're obese, so we're going to make sure you don't get that access to food. Oh my God, Laura, this is nuts.
It's absolutely twisted. It really is. I think one of the saddest thing about the way that we perceive work is that people are hungry when they don't need to be, homeless when they don't need to be. It's also very sad because work can be very fun. Work does not have to be something that you do out of terror of being on the streets. Work does not have to be something that you do because you're trying to keep your head above water. It doesn't have to be such a source of pain. Work is really fun. If you're doing something that you love, work can be really fun if you're not terrified out of your mind. And I think the real tragedy of this is that capitalism actually divorces us from, I mean, it's the, you know, the Marxist argument, if it divorces us from our labor, it alienates us from the thing that makes us human, which is the joy of production, the joy of doing something really cool. I love my job. I sure wish that I could go to the grocery store and buy more things than I do. That's what's sad about it to me. And the thing, yeah, where you blame people for this world that we've made, where increasingly as technology gets better, as labor trickle, as the fruits of labor go in more and more to the very wealthy, and it becomes more and more impossible. And then what do? You turn around and you say, it's your fault. Stop being poor. Why are you so obese? Because of food deserts and eating fast food instead of real food. It's a vicious cycle, and it's getting worse, and it does have to be disrupted, and it's hard to see how.
And Stephen, last but not least, I was telling people the other day that I did morning drive time radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul in the early 2000s. And I remember that they were trying to restrict what you could spend your money on with your food stamps, okay? And that was the big deal, that there were too many overweight poor people, and they were going to restrict the things that they were able to buy with their food stamps. So you know what I did, Stephen? I had the governor on my morning drive time radio, and I said, really? I said, and you are in charge of the fact that we have a public education system, and there's going to be school lunches and school breakfasts, and obviously we're going to say, look what we do when we're in charge. I said, can I read you the breakfast program for Minneapolis and St. Paul? Let me tell you what's on there. Pop-Tarts, Cocoa Puffs, chocolate milk. I said, oh, really? So you want to tell poor people how to spend their welfare food stamps, and yet when you have money, look what you're buying. Look what you're buying. Again, we don't even know how to point out the hypocrisy. In the end, they don't care. And I don't know how to explain to people that ultimately when your politicians don't care, it's you that gets sacrificed.
Yeah, I don't know how you convince people that people shouldn't have access to food. It's one of those things. It's like, geez, that seems obvious to me. Just super quickly, there are, in fact, higher rates of obesity among poor and low-income Americans than among other groups.
Oh, yeah.
Precisely because calories are cheaper than nutrition. And calories are cheaper than nutrition because we subsidize the corn industry, and everything in your grocery store is made of corn syrup.
And Iowa is what? The epicenter of corn. I mean, so again, you almost want to have that as the backdrop behind Governor Reynolds. I love this group. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. We need to thank Laura Jadid, Stephen Pimper, and Lincoln Mitchell for joining us. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better think-